you. I was hoping to be like how it works or something, you know. Take a lot. My name is Matt Crane. I'm an alcoholic. I've been sober since November 11th, 2012. I have a sponsor. I sponsor other guys. My home group is Speaking of Steps in Richmond, Virginia. Come see us on Wednesdays at 8 o'clock, Sundays at 6:30. And, well, maybe I'll talk about some of my service work later on, but I also do service work. I want to thank Sam for asking me to come up here. I am genuinely very glad to be here. I'm very glad to have spent a bit of my time driving up to this meeting, doing something for Alcoholics Anonymous. I think I like to think that, you know, I don't know, the girl or the car or the whatever, the latest distraction or toy is going to make me happy and all that. And truly the only thing I found that that does that is this program. And it's never the first thing that really pops in my mind, you know. It's always the girl, the toy, the stuff that I come up with, you know. And I'm slowly learning that this is the thing that kind of sets me straight. So it's funny though. I would never guess that. I would not have known that. I would have thought it was crazy, you know, 6 years ago, to hear myself say that. And I, you know, I'm like in my, you know, the suit. It's the one suit I own. With the tie, I learned to tie when I got sober. I own a few ties. In my car, it's the nicest car I've ever had. And I'm feeling like a big shot, you know. And like my companion is my big book, you know, on the passenger seat. So anyway, I guess I'm a big shot, you know, in my own mind. But you guys are big shots in my mind because a lot of you come to speak in Richmond. So in my mind, the Blue Ridge Group is kind of like this like mythical place full of like amazing sobriety, which it probably is because you guys have. I've always enjoyed hearing you speak at Outlaw Safecracker, Jaywalkers, meetings like that. But anyway, I'm going to get to it. I'll tell you what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. I was born in Hong Kong in 1985, so I'm 33 and I'm English. Being 33 wasn't relevant when I was 5 and moved to America, but being English was. And, you know, I hear people here talk a lot about feeling different, feeling like apart from. I don't know, like if normal people had meetings where they like got together and told their life story, I don't know if everybody would say that or not, but I go to Alcoholics Anonymous where people tell their life story and I hear that a lot. And that was true for me. I just remember feeling different, kind of because I was. I didn't like the way I talked. I had an English accent. I tried to like get rid of it. And I wish I could like kick my 5-year-old self's ass because like it would be nice to have that thing. anyway, you know, my house growing up, I can't really complain. I was just thinking this morning about, you know, like Memorial Day. Sometimes I'd march in the parade. We had this like town parade. It went past my house. My neighbors would have like donuts and coffee and stuff. And, you know, everyone was running around. It was like it was kind of a safe, nice neighborhood in Connecticut where I grew up. So I don't think it was like I didn't have a bad childhood. My dad is probably one of us. He hasn't ever said that, so that's on him. But he drinks a lot, and he's an asshole. So I don't know. Got some resentments there. But you know, he was away a lot. He traveled a lot, and I don't know. I guess there was always like this tension in my house. My house was not the place where we all hung out. I'll just put it that way. And I spent a lot of time outside of my house trying to get away from my home. That is what it is. You know, I had a lot of friends outside of school. We'd ride bikes. We'd, like, build forts, like, throw rocks at each other, just do, you know, stuff that boys do. In school, that's where I remember, like, I didn't know where to sit in the cafeteria, you know. I didn't know how to, like, relate to people. Even then, looking back, it seems like people had an easier time of it getting along. And that sensation really just kind of has stuck with me throughout my whole life, is this feeling of, like, how is everybody else doing this? And why can't I? That goes on. I'm just fast-forwarding here because I want to get to the part where I get drunk and then maybe get to the part where I get sober. The first thing I found that I really liked was vandalizing stuff. Man, if you've ever like broken someone's patio furniture at 2 o'clock in the morning, like it's awesome. And I loved it. And I would do stuff like that. You know, skateboarding. But I remember like when friends of mine were like smoking pot or drinking or something, I was like, that's what bad kids do. I don't know where I got this from because my dad drinks so much, but I get to high school. And I think like two things kind of happened at the same time, and I won't dwell on one of those things, but I will definitely dwell on the other one because it's drinking. I started drinking, and I didn't plan to drink the night I had my first drink. It never even crossed my mind. I never even really thought about drinking. I'd had like one of my dad's Rolling Rocks, and I mean like I had like a sip out of it at a barbecue one time. It tasted like crap. That's it. And I had a sleepover at my buddy Dave's house, and Dave M is one of us. He and I talk sometimes, but in his kitchen, I mean, I can't tell you. Like, people come to me all the time and be like, "Man, do you remember that thing we did 6 months ago?" And I'm like, "Nope." This happened 20 years ago. I can tell you exactly what his kitchen looks like and where you can find the liquor. And my first drink was Wild Turkey 101 in a Taco Bell Cruiser cup, like one of those big plastic cups. With Pepsi, and I've always loved bourbon. I guess I got a taste for it the first time, but I drank that up until the very end. Jim Beam was really more my thing, but so we drink this stuff, and I didn't have that sensation that some people talk about of like, you know, the lights came on and I just felt great. I had a good time. I had a really good time. We watched an Adam Sandler movie, which is like the only time Adam Sandler is funny, I think, is when you're really drunk. But we thought that was great. And then Dave like pissed all over the couch and slept in it. He was puking all night, and it was awesome. It was like legendary at school the next day because we're 14, you know. And that was kind of the beginning of my drinking, was that suddenly around the lunch table, you know, it's like center of attention I've got this reputation now. I party, you know. I'm at the center of this whole burgeoning movement that's happening among my 14-year-old friends because we're all discovering liquor, and I was one of the first. And then the next weekend, I did it all over again. It was gin this time, and I got really sick, passed out in a snowbank. I don't know. I mean, I could have died, I guess. I don't know. But I got really, really sick. I didn't drink gin probably until, like, the last month that I was drinking. So it was, like, 15 years I didn't drink gin after that, but... So that was the one thing. And the other thing is I started riding mountain bikes. That was like this, I started doing that. And I started doing that, in like eighth grade, and I started racing them. And these two things, are related because I love cycling. I love riding and racing bicycles. And I was pretty good at it. And by the time I was 16, I switched to road bikes, like Lance Armstrong style stuff, shaving my legs, all this kind of thing. And I was really, really serious about it. And I was so serious that I didn't party. I didn't drink. And I got made fun of all the time, which is really ironic, looking back, but all the time because I wasn't partying. And I wanted to be a bike racer. And by age 18, I was racing in like France. I was racing in Canada. It was kind of taking off. And I cared deeply about it. And I went to school. I went to Colorado for college. I didn't want to go to college. It just seemed like the thing to do. And as soon as I got there, I just knew right away I didn't belong. I didn't want what these people were doing. I didn't want to get a degree. I didn't want to go to class. I hate school. I just wanted to ride my bike. So I dropped out. I was able to join the U.S. National Cycling Team, and I was like on my way to what I wanted to do, which was to race bikes for a living. I'm going to talk about drugs for like 2 seconds here, but I'm going to tell you this. Somebody came to a meeting in Richmond a while ago and they were just like talking about like, it was just like, it might as well have been not an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting, I'll put it that way. And they said, if you got a problem with that, talk to your sponsor. And I was thinking like, man, you got to get a new sponsor. I'm not going to sit here and talk about drugs because I respect Alcoholics Anonymous. This program saved my life. And I'll also say this. I like things other than alcohol. I'm not just going to stand here and pretend that all I did was drink. That would be silly because that's not true. But I figured this out, that you can give me all the drugs in the world. I like the ones that prick your nose. And no alcohol. and that deal will not work for me. I'd be like, that's a crappy deal. You can give me all the alcohol in the world and tell me there's nothing else allowed on the table. And I'd be like, that's fine. I'm okay with that. Give me, I just want to drink. There's just something different about drinking for me. And I really only ever liked drugs because they let me drink more and they were part of this whole drinking thing I was doing. So a lot of times when I talk about drinking, I mean partying. You know, I'm drinking, I'm doing other stuff. You know, I like to just get, you know, I like to get really sloppy. I don't want to be me. I don't want to feel feelings. Just give me whatever you got. So with that in mind, you know, I did have two kind of profound experiences with drugs. And one of them was I was 16 and I broke my collarbone. And I remember being in an Applebee's with my family because they came and picked me up from the hospital and then giving me some Vicodin. And I was just like, for the first time, I felt like everything was just okay. I just remember being like so happy sitting in this Applebee's eating a burger. There was that. And then when I was 19, I've left school. I'm racing my bike in Europe for the U.S. national program. And I broke my collarbone again. And I couldn't ride my bike. I started, you know, drinking and doing drugs and stuff. And that's when I, looking back, was one of the big times when I stopped being able to control it. And what I'd always wanted was to be able to turn it off, you know, and then do what I need to do and then, like, turn it back on. And I stopped being able to do that. And from then on, this thing I like to do, which is drink, and this other thing I like to do, which is ride my bike, they never were separated. And it was for the next, up until I was 25, I turned professional. I fulfilled my dream of doing that. I'm racing my bike, it's my job. But stuff's starting to get weird, you know? Like, I'm showing up at like the biggest race of the year, and I've been up until 5 in the morning drinking, taxi drivers taking me around, not real taxi drivers, like gypsy cab drivers. You know, and like, it's like when people are starting to question, you know, like, what's going on? You know, like, you know, why aren't you fulfilling your potential? You know, and I just started to feel like an imposter, you know? I'm like this professional athlete, but I drink a lot, and I smoke a lot of pot too. And my life just kind of started to feel like this house of cards. So for me, a lot of times, like at night, I would just be gripped by this terror, you know, thinking about like, I haven't paid taxes for 5 years. I've got a DUI. I don't have a driver's license, but I'm still driving. I've got all these credit cards maxed out. I'm kind of partying more and more and like, my career is falling apart, and I don't know what the hell I'm going to do. And it just started, you know, just sometimes the walls really close in on me. So I'm living this double life. And I got DUI, like I just said. And I remember one thing from that. You have to go to this, like, class. And I drove to the class with no license. And I remember, like, going out for drinks during lunch for this class. And I remember the instructor talking about stuff like, if you drink before you go out drinking, maybe you should look at that. If you can't be comfortable around other people unless you've been drinking, you should look at that. If when you drink, you have no idea what's going to happen. If you start drinking and you don't know how many you're going to have. And I was like, yep, that's all pretty interesting information. And I was like, maybe I should try to regulate my drinking. And I tried. And I think for like 2 weeks, I would go out to bars, and it just sucked. It was awful, and it just didn't work. And I just drank the way I would and drank. I never tried that ever again. And then at a certain point, obviously, it all just kind of fell apart. You know, it wasn't super dramatic. I guess I was living in Los Angeles. I just moved out there with a girl. That didn't work out. It turned out she was pregnant, and there's that whole thing. My best friend's dad passed away, and he was like a father to me. Growing up, I spent a lot of time with him. And if I talk about my amends, if that comes up, that will become more relevant. But he had pancreatic cancer, and I'd done something really bad to them when I was a kid. It wasn't like this horrible thing, but vandalized their house. Remember, like the vandalism thing. And I was so ashamed of this that I couldn't talk to him when he was dying, and he was. So that was tough. And then I got fired from my job, from my team. And what I did is I went to go live on my buddy's couch, and I started drinking, and this was 2010, and I just couldn't stop. And what I would have done before is I would have, like, done a lot of heavy drinking in, like, October, November when I wasn't racing and when I wasn't, like, on. And then I would, like, try to dial it back, and I'd kind of, like, cobble together this, like, hybrid of, like, drinking and, like, training as an athlete. And I just couldn't do the training thing. I just couldn't get it started. I didn't give a damn about anything except drinking. And I remember I made the decision to quit. You know, it's like it's time. I'm done with the sport. I don't want to do this anymore. And I felt this sense of relief. Like, thank God. Like, it's over, and now I can drink. Like, there's nothing holding me back, and I can just do this thing. I started working in restaurants. Actually, before that, I worked at an Urban Outfitters, which is really embarrassing because I was like 10 years older than even the manager there. And I stole a lot of stuff from them, which I made amends for later. And then I got a job in a restaurant. I loved working in a restaurant. It was like coming home, man. Like, everybody there was an alcoholic, you know? Like, it was, you know, I don't know. We're trading all kinds of stuff, you know, and yeah, it was good. Made a lot of cash. I spent it all that same night, and I would show up to work the next day. I'd work like 7 days a week because that was the only way I could sustain myself, because the money was never in my hands when I woke up the next day. And I felt, again, like, thank God, you know, I let go of this thing that was holding me back, and I could just party. But I also started to feel this, like, sense of, like, dread and guilt, like, kind of knowing, like, what have I done, you know? And, like, you know, I had a dream. I had this thing that I wanted to be, and it's gone. And I knew it was gone, and that I had probably screwed the pooch on that one. So I keep working in the restaurant industry, and I guess my life started to take on a pattern. And the pattern was I would wake up at like 3 p.m., 5 p.m., and immediately have this sense of, like, the world falling on my shoulders, and horror and shame, you know, and can't believe I did it again, you know. And you know, 'cause I told myself I wasn't going to drink that night. I told myself that I was going to dial it back, and I did it. And, you know, I'd have no money, you know. I'd be like, can I even afford gas to get to work? You know, there'd be, like, empty baggies with white powder in my pocket. It'd be crumpled packs of cigarettes. And I'd think about killing myself. And I'd, like, just drag myself into work. I mean, just looking back, I'm like, I don't even know. Like, my job was to be around people and, like, serve them food. I don't know how, like, I mean, it's just, but I just muscled my way through that. And the funny thing is I wouldn't, like, do anything. I wouldn't drink. Because I'm not an alcoholic. Like, I'm not going to, like, I don't need to have a drink to work. I'm not an alcoholic. And then at the end of my shift, you know, I've made like $200 or something, and you get a free drink. And I, you know, and what I would have told myself during the shift was like, all right, I got to stop this. I'm going to go home tonight. I'll have a big dinner, healthy dinner. And I'm going to wake up tomorrow, and I'm going to fix some stuff. My life needs to be fixed. I got to maybe go to community college, save some money, you know, get that thing fixed on my car, whatever. I'm gonna pull this together. And by the time I got done with work, it was like, man, I'm pretty proud of myself. You know, I got through the day, feeling pretty good. It's not that bad. I feel okay. I'm gonna have a drink. I'll have a beer. I'm gonna have one beer, you know, just to relax. I've earned it. And then I'm going to go home, and I'm going to fix my life tomorrow. All right. And I'd have that one beer, and then it would be like, man, that went pretty well. I'll have a shot and then a beer. And next thing I know, it's and this was every time. Next thing I know, it's like 6 o'clock in the morning. And I don't know about you, but I don't like that, like, gray dawn, you know, because the night's over, and that means, like, it's over, and it's time to, like, go back to your hole and be miserable and try to fall asleep because you can't get away with it anymore because now normal people are coming out. And I'd see the normal people coming out, but they're like, you know, minivans going to work. And I'd be like, how do you do that? You know? And I'd be like, what is the matter with you people? And it was just so bizarre to me. I kind of wanted it, but it was just seemed so alien that you could just have your stuff together like that, you know. And I'd just be, you know, just ashamed of like, oh my God, like, you know, just hoping no one would see me, you know, because they would know exactly what I was. Like, I must have, you know, I know what I looked like. I had hair down to here. And I just like scurry home and eat some sleeping pills, and then I'd wake up and do it all over again. And again, I'd wake up and that shame and that horror and just like. So I decided I needed. You know, I was living at my mom's house at this time, right? I'm living in the basement of my mother's house, and I decided I need to move to New York City. That is, I'm not. This boring ass town is holding me back, and they're not. These people don't understand the vibrant artist that I am, and I need to get out of here. And like I remember. I mean, people, you know, like my drug dealers were like, man, I'm worried about you. I don't think you should go to New York City. I don't think that's a good idea. they were right. New York's great, and I love it, but, you know, everything is on all the time, and it did not help me in any way. Actually, it might have, because it actually, maybe it just threw, like, kerosene on the fire, and, you know, I don't know. But I started working in a restaurant there. Everybody hated me at this place except for the management. I work hard, but so the management likes me. Everybody I work with hates me because I'm just miserable. I am such a prick. Like, just don't look at me. Did you look at me? You know, did you walk in front of me? You know, I just got a comment for everybody. And but at this place, something would happen at 10 o'clock. This place would open really late. And so at 10 o'clock, we'd get like this big rush of people coming out of the theaters. And so they'd get everybody in the service bar, and they'd give us all shots of Jameson. And after that shot of Jameson, it was like, I was on. And I developed a taste for Jameson after that. You know, it's like, this is, man, Jameson is good stuff. I know now kind of what was happening. I was having kind of like my first drink. And it was just taking it away, you know, and I drink through the rest of the shift, and you know, I'd go out and embarrass myself and embarrass my coworkers. I remember there was this short guy, who was Irish guy, and I'd like pick him up and like parade him around, and he took me aside one time and was like, "I fucking hate you, you cunt." sorry, I didn't mean to swear near me, but you know, and I didn't know why. I was like, "Why? Why are you so uptight, man?" You know, probably because I embarrassed him horribly. And anyway. So, but I thought I was funny, you know. I thought I was funny, you know. I was, if you had a problem with that, that was your problem. There's something wrong with you. I'm one of those unfortunate people who thinks that after a few drinks, he is really, really funny. You know, just anyway. My last drink wasn't that different from any other time. You know, at the time, I'd been kicked out of the apartment I was living in, and they'd given me, like, a grace period because I threw some money at them, and they let me, like, crash there a little longer. Hurricane Sandy had just decimated New York, so the restaurant I was working at was destroyed, and I lost my job. And what else? Yeah, and I was sleeping on, I didn't have a mattress, I didn't have a bed. I had this, like, I was living in Brooklyn, and I had this, like, how do we call it, like a pool lounger, you know, like the sunbathe on. I had the mattress from one of those, the pad from one of those, I slept on that. And the same pattern was happening. You know, I'm working this restaurant, except coming home, you know, and then waking up, and same thing, horror, dread, shame, no money, what the hell am I going to do? Going to kill myself, I don't know, go to work, and then, you know, all this. And, so, I don't know, I didn't have a job, and I was just kind of doing my thing. I've been awake probably for like 2 days, and, you know, just hanging out with my people who sleep on the street. And I went to this, I was on this, like, tour of the city. I was, you know, selling my drinks and stuff, and I ended up at this bar called Niagara Bar on Avenue A, and with the last $5 I had, I ordered a Yuengling on draft, tipped the bartender. That's it. Actually met a guy in my home group about 8 months ago who used to bartend at that same bar, and he worked there during the time that I was drinking, so he might have served me my last drink. I don't know. But anyway, and I walk home, and nothing different. That's my last drink. And I'm walking across the Williamsburg Bridge, like a 5 mile walk home. And the thought I'm having is, what the hell is the point of all this? Like, what is this all about? This life thing, you know? I mean, like, I don't get it. And like, I want to die so badly, you know? I want to kill myself so badly. And I could jump off this bridge. And like always, I was immediately like just so resentful of my mother and my sister, because I thought of them and it was like, I can't do it. I can't do that to them. And that would always be the thing that kind of like drew me back. And I would just hate my mom, you know, like, man, like, I didn't ask to be born, you know, literally, like, I didn't ask to be born. I never asked you to bring me here. And now you're keeping me from like getting out of this. And then I'd have like other thoughts like, well, wait, what if I jump off the bridge and then like, there's this other world and I'm trapped in that? I don't know. And I couldn't see any point of this whole thing. And it seemed to me that the only purpose in life was to get drunk and to time one on, maybe get laid. That wasn't happening a whole lot. I get home. I'm in my apartment and I was seized with this terror like I've never felt before. And the terror was that I didn't know what to do. And I was seeing what my life was. I've always been able to justify and rationalize and become an optimist about whatever situation I'm in. I've always got a plan. Like, I'll fix this. I'll make it better. I've got some, like, lily pad in my mind I'm going to jump to. You can't get me down. And I wasn't seeing what was happening. You know, I was thinking that, like, all of these things, my life, this was my choice, you know, or this is just the way it was. And I saw for the first time that I had no plan and that my life had been getting a lot worse for a long, like, it had been getting bad for a long time, but now it's getting a lot worse. The other thing, the final thing, was I realized that I was never going to control my drinking, that I was never going to wake up and have that day where I didn't drink and I pulled my life together. And I was terrified because I was like, I had no lies to tell myself, you know. I couldn't tell myself that it was fine what I'd done tonight because I was going to wake up tomorrow and fix it. And I knew I was never going to fix it because I never had. And at that moment, it felt like I was going to explode or be crushed. I don't know, but I just realized I was screwed. And I had no idea what to do, and I asked for help. I don't remember if I said the word God, but I was looking at the ceiling, and I was asking for help, like pleading for help, not like a foxhole prayer, like a deep within myself, please help me prayer. And I woke up the next morning, and I have good news. I had a plan. The plan was I was going to go home and steal all my mom's jewelry. Why didn't I think of this years ago? It's just sitting there, you know, and, you know, off, you know, and I, make a long story short, I get on a train, it's an hour train ride home with this plan in mind, and, didn't drink on that train ride. Drinking on the train is one of my favorite things to do in the entire world. You can buy a beer, like, at any train station, especially Grand Central. And if you're like me, you can have a few of them and show up where you want to be, where you want to be. And I didn't drink. I didn't really pay attention to it, but I just got on the train. And when I got home, my mom picks me up from the train station and takes me home and sits me down. And she's like, you need help. You're sick. You're really sick. And you've needed help for a long time. But now you need to get help. She was like, I found a place you can go. And it was a rehab. She was like, I found a place you can go. And, you know, maybe we can do something about this. And I was like, no. I got stuff going on. And I meant it. Like, I've got stuff going on. Like, I'm basically unemployable. But, you know, my mind, it's like, you know, there's, you know, I can't interrupt life, you know. And she's like, and I'm like, I can't miss 2 weeks, Mom. I can't just like leave life for 2 weeks. And she's like, it won't be 2 weeks. It's a month. And I was like, never going to happen. And she says, well, if you go to this place, you don't have to worry about all the stuff you've been worried about. You don't have, you know, it's going to be taken away. You're going to be safe. And I was like, okay. Yeah. Okay, let's go. Let's go to that place. That's all I've wanted for a long time, is just to be safe. And most importantly, to be left alone. Don't ask me to do responsibility. Don't ask me to pay bills. Don't ask me to show up to work. I can't handle it. Like, I just want to be left alone. Like, in a dark corner, just give me, like, food and water and, you know, alcohol, obviously. So that sounded great. And we left right away. It was, like, 10 at night. This place was in Reading, Pennsylvania. I mean, it was, like, a four-hour drive. My mom stopped at a CVS so I could get, like, stuff I needed. She gave me her credit card, but I stole everything inexplicably. And when I came back to the car, the battery had died because she'd left the heater running without the engine on. And we waited there. It was, like, late. An hour and a half, and I just sat there, you know, and we got on the road again. And when I got to this treatment place, I got this copy of the Big Book, and I remember being very confused why they were giving me a copy of the book Alcoholics Anonymous, and I was terrified that, like, I wasn't going to qualify for this place, that, like, you know, all the junkies and, like, real alcoholics were going to laugh at me. You know, because I'm not an alcoholic. You know, I don't live under a bridge, you know. I don't drink warm vodka, you know. I drink bourbon. Alcoholics drink Popov, you know. I had these ideas. I like Popov, nothing against it. But we went to this, there was like a chapel meeting. And it was, I hate church. I did at that time. So I was very, very opposed to this thing, but I was like, whatever, you know, I don't really have a whole lot going on. I've been eating Rice Krispies in this, like, detox kitchen for the past 24 hours. Just give me something. And I went to this place, and people were picking up chips at the end of the service. It was kind of like a hybrid AA meeting, I don't know. And they would give, like, mini testimonials about their life, and they would say, like, you know, my name is so-and-so, I've been sober 3 months. My name is so-and-so, I've been sober 3 years. And that was the first time I realized that you could live sober. Up until that time, the two options that were available to me in my mind were to continue drinking or to off myself. And that's, like, really all I had. I did not see any other path. And then it was like, well, wait a minute. Those people are sober, and it's like they look actually happy. And it was like the first time it had dawned on me that, like, maybe that was even possible. I had no idea that was even possible. I don't like people that drink. I actually fear and despise people that don't drink. I don't get it. But these people weren't people that don't drink. They're people that don't drink anymore. And so that was interesting. And then I meet the people who I'm in this program with, and they're just like me. You know, they're saying stuff to me. It made me realize I wasn't the only person that drank the way I drank, which is weird because I thought that everybody drank to get drunk. I didn't know that my drinking was necessarily different because I just assumed that's how you drink. I didn't know that drinking in moderation was something that normal people do. I just thought that I was some weirdo who, like, was dysfunctional and insane. But I also didn't know that people felt the way I felt, and these people did. And that started me on this journey. I won't, like, go rehab, whatever, you know. I got to talk about how much I hate my dad, and the food was good, and I got to play some volleyball. That was cool, and I'm grateful for it. I stayed there for 4 months. But I went to a lot of Alcoholics Anonymous meetings, and I was surrendered, and I don't really know why. I don't know why that I had had enough when I had enough. I don't know why that was my exit off the freeway, you know. But I sensed, in a way, finding out that I was an alcoholic was the best news I'd ever gotten in my entire life. I thought I was crazy, you know. I thought that I was not fit for life or for society. I didn't know what the hell was wrong with me. And to realize it was the drinking, Well, not that it was the drinking, because I don't have a drinking problem. I have a living problem. I really do. Drinking's always been my solution for that. And when people would suggest that I stop drinking, I, you know, bucked against that, because you're proposing to take away the only thing that that I really care about, or that, you know, it's really all I've got. So to find out that there was like a name for this like living problem, we'll call it, and that I had been treating it with alcohol, but that there was another treatment, which was Alcoholics Anonymous, was fantastic news for me. I had a big problem with the God thing. That freaked me out, the hand-holding, the Lord's Prayer. I'm one of those people who has an antipathy towards religion. But I was like, whatever, let's try it. And I had an experience that helped me with my coming to believe. I was at a meeting when I was at this treatment place, and these two cardinals landed outside the window on this railing, and I was looking at these two cardinals, and first of all, it just seemed kind of weird to me. I think the reason I paid attention was that there were two of them. I just seemed like, hmm. And I started thinking about, like, that's so weird, like, what if these birds... In my conception of the universe, like, these birds exist for no purpose. They just live and die. And there's been, like, probably billions of these things, or hundreds of millions of these things. So they all lived and died for nothing. Like, all these birds, their lives are just pointless. And I was like, so that means that, like, every living thing's life is pointless, and my life is pointless. And, like, all the human beings that have lived since the beginning of, like, humanity, it was all for nothing. And I was like, I don't think I can believe that. And that for me was everything. That was like the it cracked open this door. Because I realized that, like, I do believe that there's some purpose to this. And when I admitted that there was some purpose to this, that opened up the idea of a higher power. And it was kind of a trip when I read that kind of exact thing in We Agnostics later on. But that was the beginning of something really important for me, that my life had meaning, and I didn't know what it was, and it didn't really matter, but it had meaning, and it was worth being sober for. I'm fully surrendered at this point, and I'm just willing to say yes to stuff, and that's the only thing I think that saved my ass. I had ideas, like big ideas, like I'm going to move back to New York City, I'm going to move to Los Angeles, I'm important and special, and I need to be whatever, doing that. And it was gently suggested to me that maybe, you know, don't do that. Maybe you should move to somewhere more friendly and small. And a friend of mine in this treatment center was from Richmond, Virginia, a place I'd never been. And he found a recovery house here. And obviously, one thing led to another, and I moved into that recovery house. I will tell you, from the minute I was in Richmond, Virginia, I fell in love with it. I've just loved being in Virginia, Richmond especially. It just feels good. It feels safe. And it's a very special place for me. I lived in this recovery house, and after 3 months, I was like, yep, I'm pretty much good, ready to run the show, get a real job, you know, start making some moves. Ended up living in a recovery house for 2.5 more years after that. Kind of realized that, and something I share with guys I sponsor is like, I need to give myself a chance, you know, and that like I've made a complete mess of everything. My best efforts led me to where I was when I got sober. I was trying. I wasn't trying to be like a disaster. That was literally my best attempt at life, and it led to that. So maybe I should back off and take some direction, slow down. I couldn't find a job. If you're struggling, if you're new and you can't find a job, I've been there. I just didn't get it. I was like, I got a haircut. You know, I used to have really long hair. I was like, I got a haircut. I don't drink anymore. I'm like trying to be a citizen, and I can't even get a job like washing dogs, washing dishes, like nothing. So I rode the bus everywhere, and I went to a lot of meetings. And then eventually at a meeting, I was talking to somebody who became a good friend of mine. Turns out he manages a restaurant. One thing led to another. I started working at that restaurant. And it was a great place. I made good money. I worked with other members of Alcoholics Anonymous. So, yeah, I was serving martinis to people. But, you know, I was with guys who have been sober quite a few years and would talk to me sometimes if I need to in the back. And then, you know, I guess, what else would I talk about? I got a home group. I love my home group. It's been my home group since I moved to Richmond. I got involved with service areas, taking out the trash was my first job. And since then, that's kind of been where I like to do my service work, is at the local level, making coffee, things like that. And then something weird happened, and I share this just because I think it has something to do with like this idea that there's a higher power for me. That there's maybe sometimes my view of a higher power is that it's like this mechanism, that like there's this watch that God is in charge of, and like all these pieces line up. Because sometimes things line up and things happen that are really, really, really improbable. You know, like kind of stuff like, you know, where you see the same person like three times in one day, like in way different parts of town, and you're like, that's weird. Maybe a coincidence. I don't believe in coincidences. I think that those pieces to line up so that we run into each other those times indicates that I'm on some kind of path, maybe. And I feel this very strongly because, so I don't have a college education. I think I have marketable skills, but nothing that's too impressive on a resume. And I didn't want to be working in a restaurant my whole life, even though I like working in restaurants. I bartend and stuff like that. I got a call out of the blue one day. I was leaving the gym, and this guy, calls me up. He introduces himself, and he says he's running this youth mountain bike program. It's for kids in public housing in Richmond. And my name came up from a buddy. As you know, maybe somebody who could come work for him, and would I like to come and interview for a job? Kind of random set of circumstances. This guy who recommended me—I don't even know. I mean, I just like talked to him a few times on the phone, helping him with some clothing company he was running for bike riders. I ended up working for this guy. I ended up working for this youth program. He interviewed people who have like master's degrees and like, you know, doing this sort of thing. And I told him a little bit about my story, not a lot, but I told him a little bit. And he wanted that. He wanted the person who, had my experience. Like, you know, I spent time doing illegal things in the projects. I could relate maybe to some of the struggles these kids were going through, not personally, but what their parents were going through maybe. And I loved working with these kids. I spent a few years doing that. And led me to things I never thought I would do. And I ended up becoming a fundraiser. I started raising money for that organization. That became my job after I worked on the programs. So I became their development director. I'm raising money for them. And I actually moved jobs in January. I'm doing something else now. I found this like career, and it really began just randomly. Like I literally got a phone call out of the blue one day, and this thing kind of fell into my lap. And I don't think that means that I'm special. I think it just means that there's things going on out there that are bigger than me and I have no control over. And, whenever I'm scared or I'm doubtful, I remember those things. What else? You'd think that I stopped drinking and, I start on my way to becoming an upstanding citizen. That really hasn't been the case, actually. I've spent time in jail sober. It was for reckless driving, but spent time in jail sober. I had like major anger issues, stuff that I never did when I was drinking. I think because like I just drinking kind of chills me out. Sometimes without that solution, I really struggle with my emotions. For me, my love life has been that's been a problem. I was told to wait 2 years before getting into a relationship, and I listened to that advice. I needed to work the steps and kind of like have my own life again. And, I think I'm starting to learn, because what I will do is I'll, I'll get into a relationship and it's like, it feels so good. And, it'll feel so good that it's like, well, why the hell would I want to go to Alcoholics Anonymous? Why would I want to do, my service work? I can't pick up the phone from my sponsor, see him on a date or whatever. And, I'll get sick. Because I go to 5-6 meetings a week. That's what works for me. And then I don't. I start going to 2 meetings a week. Just things start to become a little optional. And then I lose control a little bit. I'm not as things don't roll off my back. And I'm way more of an asshole than I usually am. And I'm angry at stuff, you know. And then I lose the relationship and I'm miserable. And I'm so miserable that I like cling to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I like launch into service work and I go to all these meetings. And I start to feel really good again and my life gets good again. And then the process repeats itself. And what I've realized, my like big understanding, this might be like really obvious to some people, but my big takeaway was that that night when I asked God to remove my drinking problem, it happened. Like, it obviously happened. Like, I can look back and it's like, I had this like major problem, couldn't stop it, nothing was working, it was insanity, and then I asked for help in like a genuine way and everything changes. But I wasn't applying any of that to any other area of my life. I was handling everything. I was reading self-help books, going to a therapist. That's all great. It's awesome. And I still do that stuff, but I wasn't involving my higher power in my life. You know, I was still running the show. That's been a big part of my sobriety recently, is kind of surrendering, as I have many times since I got sober, but surrendering in a big way to this idea that, like, yeah, I can't really run it. And a good beginning, as always, for me is to go to meetings and to do service work and to talk to my sponsor about stuff. Service work, I like taking meetings to correctional facilities. I go at least once a month. There's a place out west from Richmond. And I love that meeting. It's probably the best meeting I go to all month. Those guys love it. You know, they need it. And I'm happy that they're grateful for it. And it's just profound to me that, like, there's really not a whole lot of difference between me and them at all. You know, they just got caught, you know. And I joke about that with them all the time. I don't know if they think that's funny. But, you know, it's, yeah. And it's like this, too. This is the kind of thing that works for me. And I kind of, like, bucket it, you know. I want it to be something different. I want it to be my own ideas or thoughts. But it seems to me that the best thing for me is just to say yes to this program and do it. Anytime I'm in that position or in that state of mind where I'm saying yes, my life has gotten better in ways that, like, it doesn't seem like that's how it would work. It seems like I should have some input and there should be some, like, special, you know, thing happening. But it's not. It just seems to always be pretty simple. It's AA stuff. You got like 5 minutes, I think. I guess one other thing. So the amends thing. When I first worked the steps, I wasn't feeling it, you know. And I remember saying that to my sponsor, and he was like, "Well, are you amazed? Are you amazed with Alcoholics Anonymous?" And I said, "No, I'm not amazed with Alcoholics Anonymous." And he said, "Well, then you're not even halfway through." And it's because I hadn't started my amends yet. You know, I wanted to do amends because I wanted everybody to like me again. I wanted to be back in good graces. I didn't really want to give the IRS the money I owed them. I didn't want to pay people back. But so one amends my friend Paul, my friend's dad who died, my buddy, he's one of my best friends. He's a Green Beret, and I saw him at a Christmas party. And this was a few years ago. And I asked him if he could get breakfast with me the next day because I wanted to make an amends. What I'd done is basically, like, we were like in seventh grade or something, and I don't know why, because kids are weird. But I like vandalized the crap out of their house, like, you know, messed up their cars. It was bad. The cops came to my house the next day. So it wasn't great. And I'd let this thing just fester. And he and I became friends again in high school. And I could never face his parents. I could never go upstairs. I could never be around them. I was just ashamed. And I knew that they knew. Like, they're not stupid. And like I said, I wasn't able to call this person who was, like, my really, like, a second father to me. I couldn't even talk to him when he was on his deathbed. And so I meet with my buddy, and after, like, an hour and a half of me trying to get it out, I finally come out with it. And he's like, "Oh, yeah, I remember that. Yeah, well, it's fine, man. It's cool, you know." I was like, "But I'm gonna go make lunch for my mom. Why don't you come over and say hey to my mom?" And I was like, "Okay." So I go to his house, and we come in the kitchen. His mom's sitting there, and he's like, "All right, I'm gonna go take a shower. You guys can talk." And I hadn't planned on this. I hadn't thought about making amends to the mom. And I did. And I was weeping. But I got it out right away. There wasn't any, like, messing around. And she told me how her husband asked for me, you know, as he was dying. And that she wondered why I hadn't called. And she didn't forgive me. Like, she wasn't holding it against me, but she didn't say, like, well, you're good. It was just like, that's the reality. You know, that was bad for him, I guess. And, but she told me that she loved me and that, it was okay. And that, you know, I was like a second son to them. It was okay. Those are things that, those are amazing to me that I have those opportunities. I went to his wedding in February. Never in a million years have I been able to go to that without Alcoholics Anonymous and making that amends. It was cool. I don't know what else to say. I'm glad to be here. I love my life sober. I feel like I finally get to be the person I was supposed to be. I've just kind of come to realize that, like, this is a long journey, and I appreciate that. I like that. I thought at 2 years that, like, I've got this, I'm good, I'm a whole happy person, and, you know, I'm glad that this isn't about being happy. I'm glad that it's about being whole and being useful, and I find that when I am, I do become happy. So thank you for my sobriety. It's good to be here.